Hello, this is Chuck Coffin again on BreadboxMedia.com. Again, setting the record straight, this time bringing forth an unlikely narrative. Actually, it's two narratives. I'm going to tell you two little stories. Each one is true history. Then these two narratives intersect. And at the point they merge in time, Thanksgiving is founded in that moment. First of all, follow me into the North American wilderness, early in the 17th century. And as we go on with the story, you're going to find out why Tisquantum is remembered as a hero. A hunting party of Native American Aboriginal people. These men were of the Patuxent tribe. We call them Indians falsely. They're American Aborigines. Native Americans sometimes they're called. So they were on a hunt. And one of the men on the hunt was Tisquantum. It was 1614 in the North American wilderness in the area that is now the United States, Eastern Coast. Now, there are a number of interrelated tribes that lived in southern New England at the time of the English settlement attempts at the beginning of the 17th century. Tisquantum's band, the Patuxent, occupied the coastal area west of Cape Cod Bay. Tisquantum himself later told an English trader that the Patuxent once numbered 2,000. This was greatly reduced later by the various plagues and diseases introduced by European settlement. The Patuxent spoke a dialect of Eastern Algonquin. The various Algonquin dialects of southern New England were sufficiently similar that these tribes could talk to each other, communicate effectively. Patuxent actually refers to the site of Plymouth, Massachusetts. Now, what's interesting about that area is, unlike the native inhabitants living in northern Maine and Canada, where the annual growing season was insufficiently long to produce reliable crops like maize, and the tribes in those northern areas had to live a fairly nomadic existence, the southern New England Algonquins were actually what they call rudimentary sedentary cultivators. They cultivated vegetables that made up a substantial part of their diet. They also had fish, and they also hunted. So they cleared fields, broke ground, fertilized the soil with fish and crustaceans. The women of the Patuxent tended the beds, weeding them with clamshell holes. So Tisquantum had an encounter with John Smith. You remember John Smith from Jamestown and Pocahontas? He had left Jamestown in 1614 and voyaged along the coast of New England, where he profoundly impacted Tisquantum's life and took him from obscurity and cast him into the historical records. How'd that happen? Well, Smith noted in his log that he had collected a ship's cargo worthy of furs, trained oil, and codfish, and returned with the bark to New England, leaving the other vessel under the command of his lieutenant, Thomas Hunt, who was to complete the haul of cod, prepare the vessel, and proceed to Spain, to Malaga, where there was a market for dried fish. What Hunt did was without John Smith's approval or knowledge. He decided to enhance the value of his shipment by adding human cargo, slaves. So he sailed to Plymouth Harbor, ostensibly to trade with the village of the Patuxent. And all the Patuxent had not been part of the fur trade for as long as the natives to the north had. They were producing substantial fur surpluses by the time of Smith's visit. Tisquantum and the other Patuxent had learned something of European approaches to trade, diplomacy, and military conflict, and had witnessed some of their technological accomplishments. So Hunt was able to lure Tisquantum and the other 19 Patuxent under promise of trade, lure them on board, where they were suddenly confined as the vessel sailed across Cape Cod Bay, and where Hunt abducted 7 more native men. Hunt then set sail for Malaga. John Smith was furious. He was convinced that Hunt's actions were directed at him by inflaming the local population. He could not believe that Hunt was driven by greed, since there was little private gain to be gotten. He worried about the prospect of a war new begun between the inhabitants of those parts and us, although he seemed mostly concerned about whether this event of the kidnapping had upset his gold-finding plans on Martha's Vineyard. But no one seemed much concerned about the inhumanity of this. So Thomas Hunt transported them to Spain, sold them into slavery, made very little profit out of it. But all this was noticed by some Spanish Franciscan friars who, in order to save the Indians, went and purchased them and set them free, and took them to be instructed into the Catholic Christian faith. They gave them employment, and in time Tisquanto took instructions and was converted into Catholicism and baptized. The exact history of what happened in the next few years is uncertain, but somehow Tisquanto made it to England, where he worked at a shipyard. No records really show how long Tisquanto lived in Spain, what he did there. John Smith mentions Tisquanto as living in England for several years and acquiring great skill in the English language from his fellow workers in the shipyards. The governor of the Plymouth colony was William Bradford. William Bradford, who knew Tisquanto best and most sympathetically, recorded that after Spain, Tisquanto lived in Cornhill and in the city of London with John Slaney. Slaney was a shipbuilder who became another of the merchant adventurers of London, hoping to make money from colonizing projects in America. He was even an investor in the East India Company. But his importance in this narrative about Tisquanto is that Bradford was one of the grantees of the Newfoundland patent and treasurer of the Company of Adventurers and Planters of London and Bristol, who were to exploit this grant. Now, this association may have had something to do with obtaining Tisquanto from Spain, from Malaga. How he got from Spain to England, no one is quite sure. But during this time, a virulent pestilence descended on southern New England. It was an extraordinarily lethal epidemic. That the English could live in close proximity to those afflicted with the plague leaves not much doubt that they were immune to it, that it was a European disease, what they call a virgin soil disease. In other words, it was an import. It is estimated that about 90% of the population died in North America. Among the tribes virtually wiped out were the Patuxent. John Smith wrote that in three successive years, near 200 miles along the seacoast, that in some places there scarce remained five people of 100. But the epidemic ended at the border of the Narragansett, for there was no trading between them. The conclusion is inescapable. Evidently, this infection was introduced in the peaceful commerce that the French had built up, which was the very source of the Indians' monetary prosperity and harmony. There were decades and decades of a very peaceful existence among the Indian tribes and the French. The French colonists, who were Catholic, sponsored a great fur trade, and many peace treaties were drawn up between tribes that had been rivals in the past. This produced great prosperity among these tribes, who interacted as they had never done before. Some historians say that the English had hostility between them and the Indians and eventually exterminated them. In great contrast, the French cherished the Native Americans, made friends of them, made them prosperous, and created peace among the various tribes. But the sad thing that happened is this interaction created a pathway for the spread of this terrible disease. Not many years later, a man named Thomas Morton walked the forest around Boston Harbor and wrote that he saw this. A place where many used to inhabit, there hath been but one left alive to tell what became of the rest. Those left living were unable to bury the dead. They were left for the crows, kites, and vermin to prey upon, and the bones and skulls upon the several places of their habitations made such a spectacle after my coming into these parts that as I traveled in the forest near the Massachusetts, it seemed to me a newfound Golgotha. How Tisquanto came to be in Newfoundland in 1618. Remember that he was employed in the shipyard by a man named Slaney. Now, Slaney had several businesses, not just the shipyard. Associated he was with the Royal Land Grant, whose company intended to colonize and exploit that area. It seems probable that Slaney wanted to use his employees' talents as a diplomat and translator, since he knew various Indian dialects from that region. And so perhaps Tisquanto went on one of the vessels
in the fish and wine trade.
Tisquanto is mentioned in 1622 as being with Captain Mason, governor there, for the undertaking of that plantation. When they reached Tisquanto's village of Patuxent,
where they had intended to stay for a while, they didn't stay very long at all. There was no one alive. Everyone had died of the plague. Tisquanto's home village was no more.
Now, I'd like to pause in this first narrative, this first story I'm telling, and let's jump over to the other story, the second story, and back up in time. Let's go back to England in the early 1600s. Let's go to Nottinghamshire. There's a man there, Richard Clifton, who was a parson in the Church of England. Now Clifton sympathized with the separatists of that era. Separatists, who were they? They were Calvinists.
They were followers of Calvin.
Nonconformists to the doctrine and liturgy of the Church of England, the Anglican Church. Of course, the king or queen, as head of the Anglican Church, would view them very negatively, as they would Catholics, as virtual traitors. And so these separatists endured the same tortures and murderous persecutions, drawing and quartering, and risk in every sense that the Catholics did. They were persecuted also. Now, King James I had a conference called the Hampton Court Conference, about 1604, and he condemned those who would not conform to the more outwardly Catholic usages of the Church of England. And by that I mean the robes, candles, the rituals, the bowing of the head in the name of Christ, processions, and all of that. The Anglican Church had retained all of this. The Calvinists were very spare and ascetic in their practice of their religion. They thought all that was not only an unnecessary, but a negative. So as a result of this, Richard Clifton, being sympathetic to the separatists, was defrocked. He couldn't be a priest of the Church of England. He was stripped of his clerical status. And thereby, he went to Amsterdam and was followed by his disciples. They began a pilgrimage. Here they were called the Pilgrims. These pilgrims moved around a bit,
and not finding any location in Europe where they were particularly welcome, where it was hospitable, they eventually emigrated to America.
An interesting bit of trivia is that one child was born on the board the Mayflower while at sea and given the name Oceanus. In 1621, the penal laws of England regarding nonconformists affected not only their rigorous Calvinistic Puritans,
but the Roman Catholics in England were called recusants.
So they shared their same faith. Now, the Catholics who lived in Nottinghamshire, where the Pilgrims originated,
were persecuted with great fervor.
Even today in New England, the High Church Episcopalian Anglican schools consciously play down the significance of Thanksgiving. Why? The reason is simple. At root, Thanksgiving commemorates the good fortune of political and ecclesiastical rebels against the Church of England and the Anglican tradition as a whole. But because they shared the same enemy, doesn't mean that the Puritan pilgrims were not violently anti-Catholic themselves. As a matter of fact, they left England because they thought the Church of England was too Catholic. These Puritans were strict Calvinists.
They certainly did not celebrate Christmas. That was thought to be too Catholic. To get a perspective on how they felt about Christmas, celebrating Christmas was illegal in England for a long period of time, as was Halloween. So you can be certain that Puritans did not celebrate those two holidays. They were forbidden, as was dancing, musical instruments in church, and they didn't even sing hymns. They thought the hymns were much too papist.
So on one hand, we might have a Thanksgiving celebration for Calvinists, and all Protestants actually, as Thanksgiving for the safe passage and pilgrimage of the Puritans to the area that would be New England, in the area around Plymouth Rock. So they observed that as a good Protestant holiday. Catholics might remember that they were subject to the same unjust laws they granted the crown of martyrdom to Thomas More, John Fisher, Edmund Campion, and many others. Those were the same injustices that led these persecuted people to become pilgrims and to pilgrimage to Plymouth Rock. Well, you well know the name of their vessel. It was the Mayflower, of course. They had a planned departure to exit England, with a crew and 102 passengers. They had been delayed 2 months, and very late in the year, on November 9th, in 1620, they sighted land at Cape Cod. Now, this land was well north of the land their patent entitled them to settle. They spent a day attempting to trek southward to the mouth of Hudson's River, their intended destination. But the dangerous shoals and breakers caused them to return and anchor in Cape Cod. But no one on board had any experience with the land in these parts. Now, the Mayflower had taken a lot of damage from the rough seas in the crossing and in the track southward and across those dangerous shoals. They were unable to disembark entirely from the Mayflower. So, 2 days later, after organizing themselves into something of a self-governing body, 15 armed men went ashore to gather wood and returned. They had optimistic reports of the land and soil. the next week expecting the repair to the boat to take 5 or 6 days, they determined in the interim to set Miles Standish, the sutler's military advisor, with a band of heavily armed and armored men to survey the Cape. They marched in a military file. When they encountered their first native inhabitants, the natives fled in terror. The next day, when they were confident the locals were out of sight, the armed band dug up native mounds, and upon finding winter supplies of maize and beans, they took as much as they could carry in their containers, filling their pockets as well. They found so much husk corn that it took 2 men to carry it. They got so much corn there, they called the place Cornhill, a name that exists today. They got back to the Mayflower, and the repairs there were taking much longer than they had expected. So they decided to do another foraging expedition, a much larger one this time, headed by Captain Jones. 34 men went with him. Well, this expedition certainly had its troubles. They ran into a heavy snowstorm, freezing water. They had a very difficult time. By digging in the mounds, they found some more food. He returned with 10 bushels of corn, a bottle of oil, and a bag of beans. Although they continued digging in mounds, they found no more food, only graves. Then they discovered something. The summer homes of the natives, unoccupied. They were filled with utensils, mats, baskets, bits of food, hunting trophies, and material for making mats. I quote them, "Some of the best things we took away with us." They should have realized that looting houses, digging up graves, and looting those, and then digging up the food stores, is not a good first step in gaining the trust of these native people. Just how hostile they took these actions to be, the local people showed when the settlers made their third expedition. Now let me give a little context to the culture that these British people were intruding upon and pilfering from. These Indian tribes would formerly war with each other under the influence of the French. Were now engaged in cooperating with each other. Over the years, they had developed a very lucrative trade, the fur trade, in which all these Indian tribes interacted with each other and with French Europeans. And there have been decades of peaceful interaction with Europeans, with French Catholics, who cherished the Indians and dealt with them honestly, actually made them relatively wealthy. Back on the Mayflower, provisions were running short. They had to do another expedition. So Captain Standish, in early December, took 11 settlers with 8 of the ship's crews and set off again and landed a league or two away, where they set up a barricade for the night and watched a native fire about 4 miles away. They tried to find the natives who eluded them again. After a long day of ranging up and down, they met up with the men from the Mayflower and made camp for the night. At midnight, they woke. There were cries in the dark, which stopped after several musket shots fired in the air. They convinced themselves it was a pack of wolves. They got up at 5 the next morning, took their armor down to the shallop, and returned to hear the same cries. And then they were beset with a hail of arrows. Standish fired off his flintlock, but since only a couple of men had their arms, he ordered them to wait on firing their matchlocks until they could see the attackers. They were grouped. They kept up firing, hitting the trees behind which the natives were hiding. The natives would emerge from behind the trees, fire an arrow, and then duck quickly behind it. The pilgrims kept firing at them, and they soon disappeared. They named the place of the first skirmish the first encounter. They decided to continue their search for a better settlement site. They returned to the boats, coasted westward, fell into bad weather, their rudder broke. At nightfall, their mast broke into 3 pieces. They made it into the protection, this time, of Plymouth Bay. They landed on the mainland, the site of the now extinct Patuxents, and saw former cornfields, running brooks, a place very good for situation, they said. It was here they decided to settle. Short of supplies, unprepared for a winter much colder than in England, and afflicted by the diseases that come from being shipbound in these times, they endured brutal conditions in what Bradford called a, quote, a hideous and desolate wilderness. As half the settler population died that winter, they constantly feared encounters with indigenous peoples. William Bradford complained
in his log that his fate was unlike that of St. Paul, who was shipwrecked on Malta, among people he thought were barbarians, who treated him well. Bradford complained that the barbarians he encountered,
they were confronted with savage barbarians, who were readier to fill our sides with arrows than otherwise. For long periods, they experienced nothing but eerie silence. They struggled to build a settlement on the site of the village of Patuxent and spending nights on board the Mayflower. The natives watched their movements all the while, considering how to proceed. Spring came, and guess who arrived? 'Tis Quantum. Because I'm now going to reveal that who I've been calling 'Tis Quantum, because that is how some spelled his name, is Squanto. Maybe you know Squanto. He's very famous. He was to save these people. Because he arrived, and hearing them use the English language, these people dressed in their black and white, he addressed them. I can only imagine that he had a Cockney accent. Well, I wonder what he said to him. Maybe,
could you imagine meeting with you gents here in the middle of nowhere?
Excuse me that. But the important thing is that he had come at an important moment.
He arrived at just the time they were to sow their first crops in the Western Hemisphere.
And in this regard, Squanto was about to do them a great favor, a life-saving favor. He knew just what to show them, the farming techniques that were appropriate to this geographical area. He would show them
both the manner of how to set it and how to dress it and how to tend it. Now, it's true that the Plymouth settlers were primarily artisans, printers, weavers, watchmakers, carpenters. They didn't have any farming experience, but they could use any advice they could get on agriculture. Southern New England native planting methods were quite different from Northern European manners. Fields were first cleared by burning and by girding trees, hardwood trees, to prepare for the following season. Thomas Morton observed the native practice of biannual burning of the undergrowth, to which he ascribed the characteristic landscape of New England as being like the English parks with only occasional trees. In planting season, instead of planting furrows for seeds, overturning a large amount of topsoil, the natives made small mounds of soil by hand or shell tools in which to place the seed, and when the soil was depleted, fish was added for fertilizer. When the corn sprouted, bean seeds were added to the same mounds so that their stalks could be used for support for the bean runners. Squash vines were trained along the mounds to protect the corn stalk roots and to reduce the weeds. The combination of these three plants was characteristic of native agriculture, with the legumes fixing nitrogen for the other plants, the maize providing support, and the squash reducing any need to weed. What William Bradford especially mentioned is how Squanto showed them how to fertilize exhausted soil. He showed them that if they didn't get fish and bury them with the corn seed in these old grounds, it all came to nothing. They found everything Squanto told them and taught them to be true in their later experience. I want to quote from a letter they've sent back to England that talks about this. It says this: "We set the last spring some 20 acres of Indian corn and sowed some 6 acres of barley and peas. And according to the manner of the Indians, we manured our ground with herrings, or rather shads, which we have in great abundance and take with great ease at our doors. Our corn did prove well, and God be praised, we had good increase of Indian corn. And our barley indifferent good, but our peas were not worth the gathering, for we feared they were too late sown." That was the letter. So this is the method shown by Squanto, and this is the method of growing vegetables that the pilgrims followed ever after that. Squanto was obviously rather personable and rather bright. There are many stories to tell about his achievements as a diplomat among the tribes and the tribes' interaction with Europeans. But we're going to skip all that. Let's stick with Thanksgiving. So when you sit down for that wonderful feast on Thursday, today, the day of the release of this podcast, we can recall that first Thanksgiving back there with the pilgrims who survived and had a wonderful harvest. Perhaps it's a little an exaggeration to say that the Catholic Squanto is the foundation of the Protestant holiday of Thanksgiving. But it wouldn't have occurred without him. They wouldn't have been alive without him. Thanksgiving is traditionally Protestant and marks the tradition of religious toleration. But it's ironic because the pilgrims were not very tolerant of other religions, for they set up a theocracy. You know, from time to time you hear people claim that there were earlier Thanksgivings in the area that's now the United States. And there's some truth in that, but they weren't exactly like Thanksgiving. They were certainly Thanksgiving feasts, so. There were Thanksgiving celebrations earlier, but it's the Pilgrims' Thanksgiving that has been the cultural basis that commemorates that Pilgrims' Thanksgiving. There were earlier ones? Yeah, well, there were earlier colonists, and they were not English. Now, the Protestant Pilgrims of Massachusetts, Thanksgiving was in 1621. Well, there was one a lot earlier, 1565, in Florida. That was a Catholic Thanksgiving in St. Augustine. And there was another Thanksgiving celebration in 1589 in Texas, and that was a Catholic Thanksgiving. Now, as I've thought about it, I've come to understand that it's not correct to think that these were earlier origins of the Thanksgiving holiday that's repeated every year. They were individual events that occurred earlier in history, but they were Thanksgiving celebrations, just not the ones that we commemorate every year. And these two earlier celebrations were Catholic celebrations. Squanto did represent the Catholic Church at that Thanksgiving feast of the Pilgrims. As far as we know, there might have been other Indians there, converts. Many Indians were converts at those times, Catholic converts. But let's step back 23 years prior to that Thanksgiving, to Texas, where there were Catholics celebrating Thanksgiving, a first Thanksgiving for them. In Texas, April 30th, 1598, a man named Don Juan de Onate declared a day of Thanksgiving to be commemorated by the holy sacrifice of the Mass. It's 23 years prior to that. Well, let's go back 56 years prior to the Pilgrims' Thanksgiving, to the Catholic colony of St. Augustine in Florida, and a guy that with the wonderful name of Pedro Menendez de Avila, he beat de Onate by 33 years. St. Augustine is an interesting Catholic colony. It was burned out five times, twice by Sir Francis Drake, twice by General Oglethorpe of Georgia. In Georgia, the colony's constitution forbade the presence of a Catholic. Oglethorpe later became governor. So they regularly persecuted their nearby neighbors, the Catholics in St. Augustine. As a matter of fact, one of my daughter-in-laws is descended from those immigrants from Mallorca, and they've been there a long time, since the early 1500s, celebrating the first Thanksgiving in 1565. Last year, I had Thanksgiving dinner with my daughter-in-law, Bridget, descendant of the Majorcan immigrants. Let's think about the fall of 1621. The Plymouth Pilgrims, the settlers, they had every reason to be contented with their condition, less than 1 year after the starving times. William Bradford expressed the sentiment with biblical allusion that they had found the Lord to be with them in all their ways, and to bless their outgoings and incomings. Winslow was more prosaic when he reviewed the political situation with respect to the natives. We have found the Indians very faithful in their covenant of peace with us, very loving and ready to pleasure us, but also all the princes and peoples around us for 50 miles, even the leader from Martha's Vineyard, whom they never saw, and also seven others came to submit to King James, so that there is now great peace among the Indians themselves,
which was not formerly, and would not have been without us.
And I want to add to that, that there's not time in this podcast, but Squanto went on to become the premier diplomat of the area, utilized by all sides. At one point, William Bradford proposed they jointly undertake a trading expedition to supply the use of the Swan, the vessel named Swan. They proposed equal division of the proceeds with payment for their share of the goods traded to await the arrival of a man named Weston. They proposed an expedition southward of the Cape. Squanto and Massasoit had wrought a peace, although he doesn't explain how this came about. With Squanto as guide, they might find the passage among the Monomo Shoals to Nantucket Sound. Squanto had advised them. He twice sailed through the shoals, once on an English and once on a French vessel. The venture ran into problems from the start. When in Plymouth, Richard Green, Weston's brother-in-law and temporary governor of the colony, died. After his burial and receiving directions to proceed from the succeeding governor, Standish was appointed leader, but twice the voyage was turned back by violent winds.
On the second attempt, Standish fell ill. On his return, Bradford himself took charge of the enterprise. In November, they set out. When they reached the shoals, Squanto piloted the vessel. But the master of the vessel did not trust the directions and bore up. Squanto directed him through a narrow passage, and they were able to harbor near what is now Chatham. That night, Bradford went ashore with a few others, Squanto acting as translator and facilitator as always. Not having seen any of these Englishmen before, the natives were initially reluctant, but Squanto coaxed them, and they provided a plentiful meal of venison and other victuals. They were reluctant to allow the English to see their homes, but when Bradford showed his intention to stay on shore, they invited him into their shelters. But first they removed all their belongings. As long as the English stayed, the natives would disappear, bag and baggage and all, whenever their possessions were seen. Eventually, Squanto persuaded them to trade, and as a result, the settlers obtained 8 hogsheads of corn and beans. The villagers also told him they'd seen vessels of good burthen pass through the shoals. And so, with Squanto feeling confident, the Englishmen were prepared to make another attempt. But suddenly, Squanto became ill and died. The sickness seems to have greatly shaken Bradford, for they lingered there for several days before he died. Bradford described his death in this way. In this place, Squanto fell sick of Indian fever, bleeding much at the nose, which the Indians take as a symptom of death. And within a few days, he died there, desiring the governor to pray for him that he might go to the Christian God in heaven and bequeath sundry of his things to sundry of his English friends, as remembrances of his love, of whom they had a great loss. Without Squanto to pilot them, the English settlers decided against trying the shoals again and returned to Cape Cod Bay. Squanto was not just a Christian. He was a Catholic. For the Englishman's God, the Anglican God, and the Catholic God is the same. Squanto was a Catholic. And he did great good with his life. This has been Setting the Record Straight. I'm Chuck Coughlin. Support us on our webpage. This is breadboxmedia.com.